It could have been the worst of times. It should have been the best of times. It was a time of defeat through compromise. The psalmist in Psalm 106, verses 34 to 46, outlined all of the reasons why Israel had compromised and become defeated. They had allowed the Canaanites to remain in the land in violation of Jehovah's command to destroy them, Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 5, and verse 16. They admired the ways of the Canaanites instead of abhorring them. They accepted the practices of the Canaanites through intermarriage. They adopted the ways of the Canaanites. And finally, they apostatized from Jehovah. If you'll take Numbers 2, 3, 4, and 5, remove the word Canaanites and put the word denominationalism and put a period after it, you'll have the path of the new hermeneuticists. If you've ever wondered why the nation of Israel apostatized, you begin to think about what is said in Judges chapter 1 and what a marvelous, in my judgment, fact it is as to the way it's recorded. If you'll notice, for example, in Judges chapter 1, verse 27, that Manasseh did not drive out those inhabitants, but they put the Canaanites to task work. Verse 29 says, Ephraim drove not out the Canaanites. The Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. In verse 30, it says that Zebulun drove not out the inhabitants, but the Canaanites dwelt among them. But I want you to look at verse 32. Verse 32 says, but the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites. Why the change of order there? And if you'll drop down to verse 33, it says of Naphtali that he dwelt among the Canaanites. Now, prior to that time, it had been the Canaanites dwelling among the Israelites. But now, in my judgment, you see the influence and the apostasy of the Israelites. So now the Canaanites are first, and the Israelites have adopted their ways to the point that now they're just dwelling among them. And how sad that is. The period of the judges was a period of disorder because Israel had abused her newfound freedom. There was a deviation in the lifestyle of Israel as she moved from place to place and spasmodic contact with others to continual contact and intercourse with the Canaanites. There was disunity among the Israelite tribes. Division and apostasy was now part of their everyday work and attitude. In fact, Judges 21:25 says, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And if you make application to that to the tribes, you get the idea that each tribe was doing his own thing, and there was not that unity that Israel had enjoyed in the wilderness and which in reality had kept them close to God. Now you see all of that disrupted. There is a disintegration of the religion of Jehovah as the tribes now conform to idolatry, which led and was caused by a degeneracy of the priests and the people. Wickedness was rampant in the land of Canaan. And it's sad when you read about the sons of Eli, where the religious leaders were of that day. And we'll never rise above our religious leadership. And you see where they were. There's no wonder the people in the pew, or as we would say in this time, the people in the land, were like they were. The key to understanding the period is Judges 21:25. Four times in the book of Judges, one is told that there is no king in Israel. Well, the reason there is no king in Israel is that Israel has rejected God as her king. And you see that in Judges 8:23. In 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 7 and chapter 12 and verse 12. There should have been a king in Israel. And had there been a king in Israel, there would not have been apostasy in Israel. But they had forsaken their king, God. And therefore they were doing their own thing. Twice we're told that every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Judges 17:6 and 21:25. Now that means the majority was not doing then what was right in Jehovah's eyes. And you remember Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 11:9 to young people that if they wanted to do that which was right in their own eyes, they could do that. But he said, "Know thou this, that for all these things God shall bring thee into judgment." Well, what was the background for that statement? In my judgment, the period of the judges. They had done that which was right in their eyes, and for all of these things, Jehovah had brought them into judgment. Now, the result of doing that which was right in their own eyes was that the children of Israel did evil in the sight of Jehovah. Judges 2:11 and numerous other passages in the book of Judges. Listen, folks, every time I become my own standard, I'll always do that which is evil in the sight of Jehovah. Jeremiah said that it is not in man that walks to direct his paths. And no wonder Psalms 119:89 would remind us that forever, O Jehovah, thy word is settled in heaven. It's fixed in place in heaven. Therefore, verse 105, it is a lamp under our feet and a light under our pathway. We don't know how to walk outside the direction of Jehovah God. That is, how to walk correctly. And there are problems that are existing in the nation of Israel that stem from a disregard from God's word. And if you don't believe this will parallel America and give you chill bumps, read it. There's materialism. Israel is interested in prosperity, not prayer. They want to make money. They want to do whatever they need to do to have what they want, when they want it, how they want it. There's crime. And you read this list, unsafe on the roads, Judges 9:25. You ever get scared driving on the roads? Threats, Judges 12:1. How many of you have been threatened? Cowardice on every hand, Judges 15:9-13. Theft, Judges 17:2. Prostitution, Judges 19:2. Homosexuality, Judges 19:22-23. Rape, Judges 19:24-25. Kidnapping, Judges 21:23. It sounded like reading the morning newspaper, didn't it? Why? Why did this exist back then? Because they disregarded God's law. Why does it exist today? Same reason. And it'll always exist when that is the case. And then in Judges 17:7-13, you see the perversion of religion. Now, even as bad as it was, it wasn't the worst of times. And as bad as it is today, folks, is not the worst of times. I'm thankful I live today and not in Noah's day. In Noah's day, Noah could say to his boys, "Boys, we're the only family in all the world trying to do right and tell the truth." I'm thankful today all of you can say that, and I can say that, and we can join hands and be thankful that our influence is so felt that our world has not yet gotten to the point of Noah's day. But even though the majority has forsaken Jehovah, you need to mark it down that even in the period of the judges, and this is a point that I've not heard stressed a lot from my youth up in this period of time, there was a remnant that remained faithful. Even as badly as things were, there were people there who were trying to do the will of God. Look at how meticulously Boaz followed the custom and the law of Moses in getting Ruth. He wanted to do it in every detail. He was concerned about doing God's will, God's way. And look at the lifestyle that Ruth shows us of people who are the exception to the rule and who are not corrupted in a day of corruption. And we're thankful for that. And Jehovah is working in behalf of his people. And our assigned section today gives us two ways in which Jehovah was working in behalf of his people with two illustrations of each way. I want to suggest in the first place, Jehovah was working in behalf of his people by providing direction for his people. And he did that, first of all, through Deborah, Judges 4:5. And I'm glad to see you ladies here who teach young girls and teenage girls. And I want to challenge you today to take the book of Judges and develop a lesson plan on dedicated Deborah versus devious Delilah, and show our girls a real heroine after whom they can pattern their lives. In Judges 4:5, we have two accounts of the last struggle of the Israelites with the Canaanites. In Judges chapter 5 and verse 8, the text shows us that Israel had again, upon the death of Ehud, chapter 4 and verse 1, turned to idolatry. And there you see the tremendous power of Ehud and the influence he had on them. And yet when he died, which says to me that a lot of folks weren't taking their religion home with them. It was okay as long as you had a strong leader. But what if the leader left? How many times have we seen that played out? The preacher leaves, the church goes down. That's not the way God intended for it to be. In fact, God intended for us to be what we ought to be so that when the preacher leaves, the church doesn't miss a beat. And until we get it that way, we'll never enjoy the blessings God intended for us to enjoy. But it can be gotten that way. And as a result of their sin, verse 2, Jehovah sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. Jabin oppressed them for 20 years. In Judges chapter 5, verses 6 through 8, give you the details of this servitude. And it's always amazed me that one of the things that made Jabin appear so fierce, Judges 4, 3, was that he had 900 chariots of iron. But that's not the first time Israel's had trouble with chariots of iron. You go back to Judges 1, 19. And it's not the first time they've had trouble with chariots. You go back to the book of Joshua. Chariots wasn't the problem, folks. They had forsaken God. Isn't it amazing, David, and if he's 17 like I envision him being, when that 9-foot-9-inch tall morale problem stepped out of the Philistine army, David said there was a bear and a lion that attacked the sheep, and God and I took care of them. He doesn't look much worse than a bear and a lion to me. And he ran with 5 smooth stones, and he said, I come to you in the name of Jehovah. Chariots of iron would not make a bit of difference if they were coming in the name of Jehovah. And we ought not be afraid. Psalm 118:6 is my favorite verse in all the Bible. Jehovah's on my side. What should I fear that man shall do unto me? Now that'll help you live when things get tough. Because God's on my side as long as I'm on His. The children of Israel cried, Judges chapter 4, verse 3, and Jehovah raises up Deborah. He calls her into service. Why a woman? Why couldn't she serve? Why is there a problem with her serving? Why was there not a man there? Look at what Deborah did. Look at her description in verse 4. Deborah sat in the place of authority. She's described as a prophetess. Now she's in company with Miriam and with Anna. Now she couldn't be a prophetess of God unless God raised her up to so be. So here you see the authority of God at work. And really, in my judgment, when we deal with Deborah, we ought not center in on Deborah, because Deborah centers us in on the authority of Jehovah. And that's the key all the way through Judges chapter 4 and chapter 5. Deborah stands as an example of one who was uncorrupted by the immorality of her day. In fact, I call her a nonconformist in a day of conformity. And I think she knew in practice what Romans 12 and 2 says, don't let the world pour you into its mold. Deborah had not allowed the times of the judges to pour her into its mold. Deborah is the wife of Lapidoth, and you ask the question, why didn't he step forward? Is he dead? Well, we don't know. Had he been taken over by the times? Was he so wicked that God could not use him? It wouldn't be the first time, would it? 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. But Deborah was called to serve, and the point is, even though there were men living, she was called to serve. We know it was right for her to so do because she was raised up by Jehovah. Judges chapter 2, verses 16 and 18, the text says, Jehovah raised up judges, and it's repeated again in Acts 13 and 20. So there's no problem with her having the authority to be where she was because Jehovah raised her up. Why? We'll have to get to heaven to know for sure. But look at her distinction. She's raised up by Jehovah. She didn't usurp this position. She didn't rush in and say, I'm as good as any man around here. You get out of the way and let me be a judge. Oh, no. No, she's distinguished because she was raised up. And therefore, I can conclude that whatever the reasons were for her service, they did not violate God's eternal principle of the place of women. Because God's character is that which will not contradict itself. And so whatever the reasons were, whether I ever know them or not, Deborah will never be an example to be used in the arsenal of the feminists or those who would elevate women to violate God's law in 1 Timothy 2, 6 and following. But look at her delegation of authority in verse 8. She sent for the right person. When they needed a military man, Deborah didn't jump out there and say, "I'll do it." But in her position as prophetess and judge, she knew the proper persons to use, and she sent for a military man by the name of Barak from Abinoam out of Kedesh Naphtali, which would later be a city of refuge. But when Barak arrived, look at what Deborah declared. Deborah didn't say in verses 6 and 7, "Barak, you're going to work for me." When Barak came, she declared unto him the words of Jehovah concerning the battle. And notice again in 6 and 7 that authority is given to Jehovah. Deborah claims none for herself. Well, why did she have to do that? Barak already knew what God said. Was he afraid to obey without being prodded by this judge? Well, I don't know, but I know that Deborah told Barak, Jehovah had said, "Here's the army you're to use. Here's the arena in which you are to fight. And here is that which will be accomplished." Now, what was there left for Barak to do but go? In essence, Barak didn't have to do a whole lot of thinking except in strategy, because God had already said, "Here's the army you're to use, here's where you are to go, and here's what's going to be done." And as I saw that, I thought, my, that sounds a whole lot like Mark 16, 15, and 16. Here's the army, the church, here's the arena, the world, here's what's going to be accomplished. Souls are going to be saved. All we need to do is get out and do it. And that's what Deborah said to Barak. God's laid it out. Now get out there and do it. And I wonder how many men there are who have done things because there was a godly woman back there who said, "This is what God said. Now let's get out there and do it." I heard about such of a woman. Her husband got up on Sunday morning and said, "I'm not going to church." And she said, "Yes, you are." And he said, "No, I'm not." And this went on for a while. And he said, "I want you," she said, "You are going." And he said, "I'm not going." He said, "I just am not going." She said, "You give me two reasons why you're not going." He said, "I hate everybody down there, and everybody down there hates me." Well, she said, "You are going." And he said, "I am not." And she said, "You are going." He said, "Give me two reasons why I should go." She said, "Number one, God said to, and number two, you're the preacher." Well, how many individuals have done things because there was a good woman behind him and said, "Now, let's go do it." In verses 9 and 10, you see her dedication. She supported the work of God. Barak said, "I'll go if you'll go with me." Now, that tells you something about his cowardice, even though he's a military man. "I'll go if you'll go." How many people do that? They say, "I'll go if you'll go." Barak's attitude ought to have been, "I'll go if no one goes." And that ought to be our attitude in service to God. But Deborah said, "I'll go." Doesn't Barak have any confidence in Jehovah? Is this a sign of the times as far as leadership is concerned? But notice she wouldn't send him somewhere she wouldn't go himself or go herself. And that's a lesson for leaders. What right do I have to ask you to do something I'm unwilling to do myself? And she was willing to do it. And here again, you see the importance of godly women in God's service. And when I thought about Deborah saying, "I'll go," I thought about the countless numbers of preachers' wives who have said to their husband, "Honey, I'll go wherever you want to go." And when those men have been mistreated, their family has been mistreated, they've had to move on short notice, those women have started packing. And I believe that if there were compartments in heaven, there would be a special one there for preachers' families who've said, "We'll go." Deborah said, "I'll go." Now that's faith and that's confidence in the God of heaven. In verse 14, Deborah was decisive. When the time came for the battle, she seized the moment. She told Barak when to go into battle. And it's my judgment she was able to do this because she was a prophetess. And that God could tell her the exact moment to tell Barak, to be able to go seize the moment at the right opportunity. But notice again, Deborah gives credit to Jehovah. She doesn't take any of her own. But then in 13 to 16, you see her delight. As a result of her encouragement, Barak routed the army of Sisera. And the victory was complete. And then in chapter 5, her demonstration of her faith in God is seen in the fact that she sang in victory. Her complete reliance upon Jehovah, her willingness to motivate others to obedience. When you read chapter 5, verse 2 and verses 9 and 10, Deborah was able to get the leaders to lead. Now that's the key. Leaders need to be leading. She was able to get the followers to follow. Leaders need to have followers who are following. And she was able to get the nation to remember their fellowship with Jehovah. Now there's the answer to defeating any attack upon God's people. When the leaders lead, the followers follow, and the nation or the church remembers its fellowship with Jehovah, the devil doesn't have enough power in his arsenal to do anything to us. But when those things are not present, you and I have seen the Lord's body rent and torn asunder. And how sad. How tragic. She acted by the authority of Jehovah. Deborah's very careful to exalt Jehovah in all that she did, to call the nation back to the word of Jehovah. And I say today unequivocally, Deborah worked within the confines of Jehovah's will. And so must women today. The second example of the direction of Jehovah is found in the angel of Jehovah in Judges 13, verses 3 to 23. The birth of Samson was so important that Jehovah God dispatched the angel of Jehovah to Manoah and Mrs. Manoah to tell Mrs. Manoah how she should conduct her life and how the life of the child should be conducted. And I love the attitude of Manoah, Judges 13, 8. Teach us what we shall do unto the child. And then in verse 12, how shall we do unto him? Manoah didn't say, you need to fill my wife in on how this child needs to be reared. Manoah said, it's a two-person deal, and I'm doing my part. You tell us how we. Now there's the answer to our problem today. Let's get mom and daddy back in the home. Let's get them saying us and we. I am so impressed with Enoch. In Genesis 5, Enoch walked with God. Do you know what Methuselah had that a lot of boys don't have today? Methuselah never knew a day that his daddy wasn't walking with God. I wish every boy in this world could know that. And someone said that Enoch and God walked together until the close of the day. And at the close of the day, Enoch was so nearer God's home than his home that he just went home with God. What a beautiful, beautiful picture for Methuselah. Well, here you have Manoah and Mrs. Manoah rearing this boy correctly. And God thought it was so important that the angel of Jehovah came. Well, who is this angel of Jehovah? If we just look in the book of Judges and go back to Judges 2, verses 1 to 5. He is the one who made Israel go up out of Egypt. Well, go back to Exodus 20 and read. He is the one who brought Israel into the land of Canaan in fulfillment of his promise to do so. Genesis 17, 7 and 8. He is the one with whom Israel entered into covenant. Leviticus 26, 42 and 44. He is the one with whom Israel had disobeyed when they entered into an alliance with the Canaanites. Exodus 23, 32. He is the one who would drive out the Canaanites if Israel would be faithful, but would refuse to do so if they were unfaithful. Joshua 23:13. All of these identify the angel with God. In Judges 6:11-24, the angel of Jehovah appeared to Gideon and encouraged him to deliver Israel from the Midianites. And the angel of Jehovah is referred to in conversation with Gideon as Jehovah. In Judges 13:3-23. In verse 18, the angel identifies himself as wonderful. Well, in Isaiah 9:6, that's one of the names of the Christ. When his offering had been accepted, Manoah concluded in verse 22, we have seen God. They'd seen the angel of Jehovah. But he says, we've seen God. Well, they hadn't seen the God in heaven, for no one can see God and live. But Manoah said they had seen God. We identify the angel of Jehovah with what is called the pre-incarnate Christ. Brother Rex Turner, who taught Brother Cates and I think knows more about angels, I tell him sometimes laughingly, than the Lord ever revealed. But there are good things that he has written in books about the work of angels. But I don't believe here we have a representative angel. I believe we have the pre-incarnate Christ and in his work on behalf of man. You see, this angel in Judges 13:16 is distinguished from Jehovah, but he's not distinguished from deity. He is distinguished from the Spirit of Jehovah in Judges 13:25, but he is not distinguished from deity. And if I'm right in this, and of course we'll have to get to heaven to know for sure, but if I'm right, you see all three members of the Godhead at work in the birth of Samson. That's how important his birth was. That's how needed he was at the time that he came. But Jehovah not only provided direction for his people, Jehovah provided deliverance for his people. And when the time came for his people to need a deliverer, he raised up Jephthah in Judges 11, verses 30 to 40. You read the introduction to Jephthah in Judges 10, verses 6 to 18. The children of Israel rebelled against God again. Jehovah delivered them into the hand of the oppressor. Ammon had come against Israel, and Israel searched for a leader to lead her against Ammon in battle. Jephthah was that man. Jephthah is an impressive man. Jephthah is a man who overcame his obstacles. He was the son of a harlot, Judges 11:1. He'd been driven away from home by his stepbrothers and by the elders of Gilead, verses 2 and 7 of Judges 11. And by so doing, he lost any inheritance he might have gained. He lived in the company of vain fellows, Judges chapter 11 and verse 3. And yet Jephthah was able to overcome those obstacles to be of service to Jehovah God. Jephthah observed Jehovah's power. He had not forgotten about Jehovah. In fact, he agreed to lead the people against Ammon if they would make him ruler. Notice what he said, Judges 11, 9 through 11, when Jehovah had delivered the enemy into his hand. And when he took the oath, it is said to have been spoken before Jehovah in Mizpah. Not only did Jephthah overcome his obstacles, not only was he an individual who observed Jehovah's power, but thanks be to God, Jephthah opened his Bible. In Judges 11, 13 to 28, Jephthah knew his Bible. He knew the history of Israel in detail. He was able to refute the error presented by the children of Ammon. And when challenged, Jephthah knew to give the appropriate answer. He knew the Ammonites were motivated by their service to Chemosh. And he made an argument, verses 23 and 24, on the fact that Jehovah God had given the land to Israel. I don't believe Jephthah would have been a fellow that would have been taken very easily in debate. He seems to be a sharp man and a man who knew his Bible. He was a man who obeyed the Spirit of God. In verse 29 of Judges 11, he was led by the Spirit of Jehovah to enter into battle with Ammon. And in preparation for this battle, Jephthah opened his mouth to his own hurt. In verses 30 and 31, he vowed a vow and said, if thou would indeed deliver the children of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatsoever, and I'm impressed with the number of translations that have in the text the word whosoever there, that whatsoever cometh forth from the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, it shall be Jehovah's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Jephthah was successful in battle, and when he came to Mizpah to his house, his daughter came out to meet him, Judges 11:34. This was Jephthah's only child. And now he has a problem. If I keep my vow, then I violate God's law about taking life. If I break my vow, I violate God's law about keeping my vows. What in the world am I going to do? Jephthah allowed his daughter to bewail her virginity for 2 months And at the end of 2 months, verse 39 said that he did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed. Well, how did he fulfill it? Up until about the 12th century, scholars were in agreement that Jephthah offered his daughter as a burnt offering. Since that time, and in recent years, some have said, well, there's another possibility. He didn't offer as a burnt offering. What he did was he devoted her to perpetual virginity, and some have even suggested that he devoted the rest of her life to service to God in the sanctuary. One fellow said that he wanted to offer something which was extremely valuable to him. And therefore, he must have been thinking of something more valuable than an animal. But in Hebrews 11, he's listed as a godly man. And how could he be a godly man if he had offered his daughters a sacrifice? And so he found the possibility in the language to translate the word or instead of and in verse 31. In other words, Jephthah could have been saying, whatever comes from the doors of my home to meet me as I return shall be devoted to the Lord's service. If it's human or if it's an animal that's clean, I will offer it up as a burnt offering. But this ignores what he did say. He said, I'll offer whatever comes out of my house as a burnt offering. Now, how could he get to Hebrews 11 and do that? Well, there's a big jawbreaker term in the Bible, boys and girls, that allowed him to do that. It's called repentance. And it means changing your mind about living in sin on purpose. And God commands it of all men everywhere today, Acts 17 and verse 30. Others say that Jephthah was under the Spirit of Jehovah to press the battle. And Jehovah never would have given him victory in battle as the result of such a vow. And I agree. The vow didn't have anything to do with the victory. Jephthah was under the Spirit of Jehovah to go into battle. Jehovah gave him victory over the enemy because Jehovah delivered, had raised him up to get victory over the enemy. The vow didn't have anything to do with it. It said that Jephthah did with her according to his vow, and she knew not man. And some say, well, there'd been no need to say that if she died. Well, I think there would, because there is an emphasis in the Old Testament on women not having male children and how they were to be pitied. Look at Hannah. And look at others. But I believe the answer lies in Leviticus 5, 4 and 6. 4 to 6. God gives his law concerning rash vows. I don't believe that to either burn her or not burn her were the only options Jephthah had. Why could he not have availed himself of Jehovah's law concerning rash vows? Why could he not have put into place that which others could put into place under the same law under which he lived? And offer up that sacrifice that was required. Well, his favorable mention in Hebrews 11, 32 has to do with the overall manner of his life, not one isolated incident. And I believe that it shows, I know that it shows, that he repented of that which was wrong. Don't let Jephthah doing something wrong shock you. Look at Abraham. Look at David. And you want to get more personal, go look in the mirror. And yet each of us can know that if we die tonight, we can go to heaven because of repentance. The second example of God delivering his people was Samson. Samson's a great man. He was self-willed, chapter 14, verse 2. He refused the wise counsel of his parents, verse 3. He violated his Nazarite vow, verses 8 and 9. He chose evil companions, verses 10 and 11. He courted temptation, Judges 16, 1. He committed fornication, same verse. He caused an idol to receive glory that belonged to God, 23 and 24 of 16. How could he be mentioned in Hebrews 11? Big jaw-breaking word, repentance. The overall life of Samson is under consideration. And in Judges 16, 28 to 31, you see his repentance. He called upon Jehovah God as Lord, Jehovah God. That means he saw Jehovah as his master, Lord, as the covenant-keeping God. And in my judgment, he's pleading the covenant, Jehovah. And as the powerful God, Elohim, God. In Job 11, 13 and 14, Zophar said, if a man repents, he needs to prepare his heart, elevate his hands, and reform his life. And you see all three of those in Samson. He prepared his heart, he elevated his hands in prayer to God, and he reformed his life. You see his faith in God. You see his call on his fellowship with God. And Samson's final act in this world was to the glory of God. And here you see the overall lifestyle. I missed that so long in the Bible. And I missed it right in Genesis 4 where it begins. I used to spend all my time talking about worship in Genesis 4, but I don't believe that's the emphasis. The text says, before Jehovah God ever rejected Cain's offering, he rejected Cain. And John says that Cain's deeds were evil. That talks about his lifestyle. And before the text ever says that Jehovah God accepted Abel's offering, it says he accepted Abel. Lifestyle. How are we living before God? It could have been the worst of times. It should have been the best of times. It was a time of defeat through compromise. And I thought as I read that last paragraph dealing with Samson, where those Philistines called in Samson and made sport of him and gave their God credit for Samson's being there. If that's what the denominational people are doing today with those among us who have compromised, is Satan getting credit for what some of us are doing? And may God help it never be the case that denominationalism or error or Satan ever gets credit because of the way I act.